You're both on a live line right now. We won't be starting the call for another minute or two. There's a lot of people joining us, but I just want to let you both know that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for joining us today. We'll be starting our call shortly. Thank you for joining us. We'll be starting our call shortly. Thank you for your patience.
Sorry, Harris, are you asking for me?
No. I'm letting the attendees know, Jonathan. Thank you.
Okay, very good.
Thank you for joining us. We'll be starting the call shortly. Thank you for your patience. Dr. Makovsky, Jonathan Rui, can you both hear me?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Great. I'm going to start this call with your permission.
Yeah.
Okay. Please.
Great. Okay. Thank you for joining us for GINSA's Policy Conference Call. We are honored to have Dr. Michael Makovsky and Jonathan Rui join us today. Dr. Makovsky has been CEO and President of GINSA since 2013. He previously served in the Office of the Secretary of Defense in the Bush administration. He has a PhD in diplomatic history from Harvard and is author of Churchill's Promised Land. This call will be moderated by Jonathan Rui, Director of Foreign Policy at GINSA. They will be discussing a new U.S. strategy for Iran regime collapse. When it is time for questions and answers, if you have a question, please dial 5-star. I would like to invite Jonathan Rui to start this discussion.
Great. Thank you, Harris. And thank you, everyone, for joining our call today. We've got a rather interesting topic to go through here today, which is the idea of Iran regime collapse. Just a little bit by way of background, back in December, Michael Makovsky authored an op-ed in the New York Daily News that first sort of mooted this idea of ultimately pressuring the Iranian regime into collapse. And then in January, the two of us co-authored a Washington Post op-ed entitled "The Right Strategy for Iran Isn't Regime Change, It's Regime Collapse." That came out on January 8th, shortly after the U.S. assassination of the IRGC, the Quds Force General Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad. Since then, on March 25th, in the National Interest, Mike, you authored this longer form essay that expanded upon these initial ideas of regime collapse and what a policy in support of that strategy would look like. And so I would direct everyone's attention to that March 25th article in the National Interest entitled "America Must Have a Regime Collapse Strategic Goal for Iran." So I think probably the best place to start in walking through this more comprehensive piece that you author on the subject, the most basic question I think is, what's wrong with the current policy? What problem or shortcomings were you trying to address in laying out a new strategy?
All right, thanks, Jonathan, and thank you everybody for joining. Usually I ask the questions, so it's kind of fun to be answering some of them. Thanks. Look, the fundamental issue is, look, we have with the Trump administration a much tougher policy to Iran on the nuclear program, on the region, on the regime itself. And I commend the administration for their much tougher policy. Obviously, primarily their tough sanctions policy, which is the primary goal, which is the primary instrument, I should say, of their maximum pressure policy towards Iran. That's the phrase they always use, maximum pressure. What's been missing here, so I commend the administration for this much, for what they've done after and for withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA, which I had written about before they did it, and I really think that was a very good idea if they were ready for the consequences. I think the what's missing from their policy, there are a couple things, but the basis of my piece, my essay, is that they've kind of laid out more of a policy than a goal. And those are different things. And their rhetoric has been generally rather muddled over a number, over some elements of their, over their policy, Iran, but it's never really clear about what ultimately they want to achieve from their maximum pressure policy. And let me be very specific. Generally, there are three elements of U.S. policy, even the previous, you know, whether it's Trump or Obama or Bush and so on. There's the nuclear element, there's the domestic, and there's the regional element. The nuclear element with the Trump administration, I actually think they've been very clear. The president has tweeted and has stated very clearly that, you know, we won't allow Iran to get a nuclear bomb. Secretary of State Pompeo has been even a little more forward on that leaning, which I tend to align with here, which he says we shouldn't allow them to have a nuclear weapons capability. It's slightly a stricter objective. So I think on the nuclear side, they've been very clear, and I think Trump has repeated this many times when he put in caps on things like Iran will never have a nuclear weapon and things like that. On the domestic side, to regarding their oppression of their people, the regime's oppression of their people, I'd say they were, they've been increasingly critical of the regime, starting a couple, you know, about a year and a half ago or a couple of years ago, in response to demonstrations in Iran. And certainly this past winter, I think the president has been stronger, and Secretary Pompeo has really kind of focused on that a lot, and I commend the administration for focusing more on the human rights violations and the oppression by the regime. What's been less clear is what they want to do on the region, and what is less even also unclear is their overall objective. On the regional threat of Iran, I would say that they haven't been that clear about what they're trying to do. They've generally used words like block, deter, isolate. These are generally associated with deterrence, which means they want to deter future Iranian aggression, which is effectively a status quo approach to policy. They don't actually say that, but that seems to be the suggestion. But overall, all these elements, what do they want to achieve? The administration hasn't really been that clear about it. And I think it's partly because the main instrument of their policy, of what they call their maximum pressure policy, is largely sanctions. And it kind of insulates the administration from defining objectives, because you could claim that sanctions are a tool to achieve all these objectives, to compel Iran on the to nuclear talks, which I'll get to about talks, depriving it of resources for aggression, deepening the regime's internal pressures. They don't actually say that, but that's what's suggested. But by not really articulating what their overall goal is and just relying overwhelmingly on sanctions, and again, I think sanctions are a very important part of policy, and they've done a very good job of that, but by relying almost exclusively on the sanctions tool, they haven't it's kind of allowed them to be kind of fuzzy about what the goals are, because sanctions could, you know, support a lot of policy. Now, I'll just say one last thing on this part, is that I think another challenge about sanctions, again, the exclusive, almost exclusive reliance on sanctions, is that they don't really, sanctions can't really deter or deny the retaliation, deter aggression, and they can't really deny the retaliation that they provoke, because the administration has been ratcheting up sanctions, certainly on the oil side, since last May. So it's been a year, actually, exactly. And the Iranians have responded by attacking various energy facilities in the region, ships, pipelines, and so on. And they downed a U.S. drone last June. The U.S. didn't respond to any of these. They attacked a major Saudi energy facility in September. Again, the administration didn't retaliate. So the sanctions, in a way, the Iranians are responding to sanctions by ratcheting up pressure. They've also escalated their nuclear program in response. Doesn't mean sanctions aren't a good policy, but by relying only on sanctions, they can't really sanctions don't permit retaliation and don't permit these this escalation. And in fact, they're very commendable targeting, killing Qasem Soleimani in early January, who was probably the second most important person in the Iranian government, really kind of illustrates that sanctions aren't enough. And that actually, but we get that, but that's really probably the first time this administration, almost any U.S. administration since Reagan, has really introduced an important military component to our policy. So just to sum up, the challenges, there's just been, despite the what I think is a commendable ratcheting up of pressure by the Trump administration on Iran, they haven't really, the administration hasn't articulated what its overall goal is. There's a difference between policy and goal. And on the regional side, on the regional threat, I think they've been insufficiently aggressive there, or tough, I would say, by just focusing on deterrence, which is a status quo policy. So I think, given this, I would have liked to, after I started writing this piece of the targeted killing of Soleimani, and I thought, you know, this administration needs some help, I think, in articulating what its overall goal is, to really build on the success of the targeted killing of Soleimani. So that's really the overall purpose of the piece.
And you mentioned, obviously, the killing of Soleimani is sort of an inflection point, a game changer. These are all words that you and I have used in our op-eds and essays describing sort of the moment we find ourselves in. But I want to pivot now to the strategic goal that you lay out, this goal of regime collapse. Before we go into the policy implications of pursuing that goal, I think it would be great for the listeners on our call if you could explain a little bit about what does regime collapse look like? Why is this the proper goal the United States should be pursuing against Iran? And what benefits might there be to having to actually articulating a goal compared to, as you say, the administration has sort of used their sanctions approach to pursue any number of goals that might be fortuitous?
Yeah, good. I would say that, so I've used this term, as you pointed out, I think since last fall, even regime collapse, because the word collapse is very different. The term that people use a lot when they see the word regime is they think the word that follows is regime change. And that really kind of connotes an Iraq 2003 style U.S. military invasion. And first of all, the president's taken that off the table. And I think that's perfectly legitimate to take it off the table. I'm not advocating at all for any sort of U.S. military action that is aimed at toppling the regime like we did with Saddam Hussein. I don't think the American people would support that now anyway, even if I did want that, recommend that, which I'm not. The term regime collapse is different, and that means that we should really create a policy of more comprehensive pressure. They use the term maximum. I don't really think they've done a lot of pressure on Iran, but as I stated, I don't think it actually is sufficient, so I don't think the word maximum is exactly right. I think they need to have a broader approach that has a military component, political component, economic component. Well, that's really sanctions. They already have that. And political ops, information ops component, and so on. And I think that the aim is to ratchet up pressure on the regime to really kind of intensify the internal contradictions of the regime, to intensify the pressures that are already existing on the regime, so that we could help hasten the collapse of this really evil regime that is just awful to its own people, taking hostages of foreigners, shooting people, shooting demonstrators, putting people in prison, killing people in other countries, being the leading sponsor of terrorism. This is a vile regime. And I think, though, we need to kind of do more to hasten its collapse. So I think we should be, I think the Trump administration sort of wants this anyway, or at least some elements. I get a sense Pompeo, just by his rhetoric, wants this. But they don't state that. Some people think, well, it would be put off people. But I actually think clarity, some people like ambiguity in foreign policy. I actually think clarity has a lot of value, and I think this president values more clarity. So I think it's important that we explain to our allies, to our adversaries, the American public, and also the agencies within the government what exactly our policy is, and to be very clear about it. And I think regime collapse is what the phrase that I would use, and I think that needs to be the clear goal. And because... Look, I'll state something that the closest you get a sense of what the administration wants is a phrase that Secretary Pompeo used, I think it was at Hoover Institution in mid-January after the Soleimani targeted assassination, when he said, we put together a campaign of diplomatic isolation, economic pressure, and military deterrence to deprive the regime of resources, get Iran to behave like a normal nation. Just be like Norway, right? And with a question mark in it, it led to laughter. And I don't think behaving like a normal nation or behaving like Norway is really a realistic policy here with this regime. I think we want Iran to be like a normal nation, but this regime I don't think is capable of it because it's just such a radical regime. And I think this isn't really, this might alarm some people, regime collapse, oh, isn't that sound so aggressive? Again, they'll say, oh, you're talking about military force, they'll conjure up Iraq in 2003. It's exactly not what I'm saying, actually. I'm saying that we got to ratchet up the pressure, and it's really not that radical idea for American foreign policy. I think we just have to look at our Cold War policies articulated by the father of containment, George Kennan, in his X article in 1947 when he was talking about the Soviet Union, and I'll read this because I think it's very relevant. He said that the U.S., through various avenues of pressure, should increase enormously the strains under which Soviet policy must operate to force upon the Kremlin a far greater degree of moderation and circumspection than it had to observe in recent years, in this way to promote tendencies which much of must eventually find their outlet in either the breakup or the gradual mellowing of the Soviet power. And I think his policy basically was regime collapse. And that really guided U.S. policy. It took some twists and turns under different administrations, but that essentially was our goal in the Soviet, in the Cold War, was regime collapse. Now, I would say it changed sometimes, certainly I think with détente in the 70s, but I think Reagan then kind of took it back up in the 80s. And I think that the virtue of a regime collapse policy is that it exploits forces already at work in Iran. This is already a regime that is overextended internationally, economically weak, devoid of a lot of legitimacy. It oppresses its own people, is corrupt. It has completely bungled the coronavirus, pandemic, which I wrote this piece really in February before the coronavirus really became an international pandemic. They shot down the Ukrainian airliner. Frankly, this regime cannot shoot straight except when it's pointing their guns at protesters. It's a completely incompetent regime, and I think they've completely lost the legitimacy of a lot of the working class, let alone those in the universities and the intellectual class. But based on the demonstration, the truck drivers and so on, that really is the bedrock of the regime. They just shot these people for demonstrating. So I think that this policy of regime collapse would just really kind of build on all these pressures that are already building there. I'll stop there.
No, I think there's a fascinating discussion, and especially as we discovered as you wrote this piece, when people think of the history of U.S. foreign policy, especially perhaps one of the most successful examples being containment. As you point out, George Kennan's initial formulation was indeed to have the U.S. harness the forces inside the Soviet Union to bring about its own dissolution. And I think to read how he would diagnose the Soviet Union in the 40s, as you point out, there are many, many parallels or even amplifications of this in Iran today.
Jonathan, can I just pick up on that? And then I know we wanted to talk about actual policy here. I think that Kennan wrote that essay, that Article X, in 1947. The Soviet Union didn't collapse for another 40 plus years. I think when he wrote, that was shortly after World War II, and though the Soviets had lost over 20 million people, the Soviet regime was fully in control. They were controlling half of Europe, and I don't think anyone was predicting the imminent demise of the Soviet Union in 1947. I think that's different here. We don't know when this regime will collapse. I'm talking about the Iranian regime. It will collapse one day, whether it's tomorrow or in 10 years. No one knows. And there's, even though I think it's collapsing, it could take a long time between collapsing and collapse. And we just don't know. But I think, using the Kennan analogy, I think that the Iranian regime's position now, political decomposition is far more advanced now. There are riots in the streets. They are being shot at by their security forces. There is clear dissatisfaction with this regime. The economy is in shambles. They're overexposed in their international adventurism. The regime's decline in Iran is far more advanced today than the Soviet Union's was in 1947. So I don't think this is at all a crazy idea at all, in the fact of anything. But I think it should hearten people and say, look, this is in line with traditional American foreign policy.
So before we dive into the actual policy components of your strategy, Harris, could you remind our listeners how they can get in queue to ask a question?
Absolutely. Dial 5-star. Again, that's 5-star, and you'll be in the queue to ask a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Harris. So as we pivot to what the actual policy in pursuit of a regime collapse strategy looks like, as you mentioned in the article, it's a comprehensive pressure strategy. It's got economic, military, diplomatic, political aspects to it, and since they're so in depth, I just want to take them one by one. I think that'll be easiest for our listeners. On the diplomatic front, you state quite starkly, and somewhat in contrast to what we've been hearing from other policy experts, is the last thing the U.S. should be doing is negotiate with the Iranians right now. And I was hoping you could go into a little bit more detail about why specifically that's a key part of this policy.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. And I just had a shorter piece on that recently that was published. I think that, look, negotiations, talking, it always sounds good. And frankly, in an ideal situation, it is good. You want negotiations. You want to try to work things out diplomatically. That's obviously the case. And some would argue that you want to negotiate when your leverage is higher and the other side is weaker. That's the better time to negotiate, and one could easily see that this is the case with the current situation between the United States and Iran. What concerns me, though, is a couple of things. First of all, I think the president, President Trump, is rather intrigued by negotiations. He made it clear that he would like to have negotiations. He even got on the phone to talk with President Rouhani in September that the French president had organized, but the Rouhani didn't come to the phone, literally. So I think, and it seems from the administration's rhetoric, the goal of their maximum pressure strategy is negotiations. And by the way, many people say the exact same thing. And I think it's somewhat, frankly, unless it's explained why it should lead to negotiations, it's somewhat of a mindless sort of objective, because you should only conduct negotiations if it advances your interests. Now, I think most of the time we should be talking even to our adversaries. But in this case, I think certain things are very clear. I think negotiations would be counterproductive. I think you have a regime in Tehran that is on the ropes. I think that negotiations, first of all, the regime, let's say one thing, the regime has shown no interest in negotiations. That's been clear. Or if they do, certainly without any preconditions. One of their main preconditions, their main precondition about having talks is that there be relaxations on sanctions. And so I think even if they agree to have talks without the relaxation of sanctions, which I don't think they would do, but let's just say they would, I think that makes it harder for the United States to enforce the sanctions that we have in place now. I think it would kind of invite other countries to kind of resume or ratchet up their commercial ties with the Iranians. So I think, but generally, I also think besides the fact that regime doesn't want talks, I think I can't conceive of any talks that would actually be very fruitful, because I can't imagine the Iranian regime willingly giving up the terrific achievements they achieved in the 2015 nuclear accord, the JCPOA. Specifically, and it's very relevant to this year, I can't imagine them agreeing to saying all these restrictions on our arms exports, on our nuclear activity, which are planning to sunset. The arms embargo is planned to sunset this fall, and some of the nuclear restrictions are going to be coming off in a few years. That was one of their most important achievements, was the sunset clauses. And I can't imagine, unless they're literally about to fall, well, how the regime would ever give up what is clearly like their golden ticket. So I can't imagine that. I can't imagine them ever conceding that they can't, let's say, develop ballistic missiles anymore, which is also an important concern, not just for the United States, but for the Europeans. So I don't think they'd go anywhere anyway. I think the only negotiations we should have with the Iranians on their nuclear program is if they come to us, kind of like Gaddafi came to us and said he's willing to give up his whole nuclear program. Then I think that would be a very useful discussion with the Iranians. And if they're willing to do that, I think it would be very useful. Or if they're willing to say, we'll give up the sunset clause, we'll stop the ballistic missile, and somebody will stop our foreign aggression, et cetera, then maybe we should consider it. But unless it's something like that, I think we'll just be offering a lifeline to their people, to the regime, which we shouldn't be doing. We need to be aiming for regime collapse, not regime maintenance. And the JCPOA not only helped maintain the regime, but that was regime augmentation. It strengthened the regime. And the last element I think of this about the talks is that I think it would also send the wrong signal to the Iranian people that we're willing to negotiate a deal with them, even though they're shooting at their people, and imprisoning them. And with all the demonstrations that have happened in Iran over the winter, and that have happened in the last two or three years, that it could be business as usual with the United States and the West. I think that'd be that would be depressing to the Iranian people. And I think when we should be encouraging them, on the other hand, to really be opposing the regime. So I think it would send the wrong signal and help save the regime, and I don't think we should be doing either.
So in addition to the diplomatic plank of the strategy, and sort of returning a little bit to the earlier conversation about George Kennan and antecedents in previous U.S. foreign policy and grand strategy, two key components of your policy here revolve around deterrence and rollback. And I was hoping you could expand upon sort of what you mean by bolstering deterrence against Iran. We'll start with the deterrence side of the equation. Bolstering deterrence against Iran, especially in light of what you called the opportunity or inflection point that was created here with the targeted killing of Qasem Soleimani.
Yeah, I think that, of course, that happened in early January. I think it was January 3rd. I think, you know, time has elapsed. There have been some more attacks on the U.S., on U.S. forces or on bases where U.S. forces are based and in Iraq. And while we've retaliated, I have worried that our deterrence has actually, which was really given a real shot in the arm with the targeted assassination of Soleimani, I think it's actually kind of weakened, unfortunately, a bit over time. But I think that it would be good. I do think the Soleimani targeted assassination still is a singular important development in U.S. policy, and I do think it keeps the Iran regime guessing still. They just, after really literally 6 months of inaction, no retaliation, even downing of a U.S. drone, the United States is something like this, which was a real blow to the Iran regime and to their regional aggression. So I do think the regime still worries about pushing this administration too far because they really have no idea of what the U.S. will do. And I don't think anyone saw this coming with the Soleimani hit. But I do think it would be good to maintain this, try to restore or maintain some sort of deterrence against the Iranian that I think began with the Soleimani targeted killing, and just bolster our deterrence and signal our resolve if they do anything. So if they attack any base, against where U.S. forces are, contractors will retaliate very strongly. I think that has to be clear. Then there's another element, which I assume you will get to, which is a little more of an offensive strategy. Is that right, Jonathan? You want to?
Yes. And the key word there is more offensive. So this essay in National Interest, I think, is one of the longest discussions of the concept of rollback that I've seen, certainly since the Cold War. And it's almost a complement to the deterrence side of the equation. And in your case here, you've mentioned both direct rollback by the United States, but also rollback by proxy, as you call it. I was wondering if you could sort of go through a little bit some of the key policy recommendations that come out of a rollback strategy and why rollback is so central to a regime collapse strategy.
I think now that phrase rollback was a phrase that was popularized in the 1950s in the Eisenhower administration. Secretary of State Dulles used it. I'm not a huge fan of the Eisenhower administration, and I don't think the administration then really followed that policy. But the idea of rollback is deterrence is somewhat of a status quo approach, as I was saying earlier in the call, and you want to deter future aggression. That's important. I'm not minimizing that. It's important. But I don't think it's sufficient here, and I think it's important to roll back Iranian gains on different elements of their threats. And I think that would not only improve our security position, and it's an important goal in its own right, but it would also facilitate or advance our overall policy of regime collapse, because it would raise a lot more pressure on the regime. And I'll be very specific. So I think there's a U.S. rollback element. Certainly, I think we could be more active. And none of this really doesn't mean any more boots on the ground or anything like that. None of this involves that. I think, though, we could try to interdict Iranian weapons transfer via air or on land. Or by sea, let's say. So by land and by air and land, the only, let's say, weapons going to Syria or Lebanon, or by sea, let's say, going to Yemen. I think the United States could, it would be upholding various UN security resolutions to do that. It would be a little more assertive, certainly, by the administration to do that. I think we could consider shooting down their ballistic missile tests, since the ballistic missile test is probably, their ballistic missiles is probably the most, that's their most growing threat to the U.S. homeland, because their ability to deliver a nuclear weapon to the U.S. homeland is really most likely by a ballistic missile. We don't want to face from Iran what we're facing with North Korea. So I think we could be more aggressive about the ballistic missile program that they have. Now, if we want to be even more assertive, and at some point this might be the case, I don't know, I'm not saying this right now, but the Iranians continue to escalate their nuclear program. Obviously, we should consider destroying their nuclear program. Now, that would be a, that is also might sound very aggressive to some listeners, but that's really what President Obama said even in 2000, I think it was like February 2009, when he talked about using all elements of U.S. power to prevent a nuclear Iran. I don't remember exactly the language, but it was something like that. And all presidents have kind of threatened things like that. We just haven't really decided to actually implement such threats. At some point, I'm not saying this today, but at some point I think that might be something, but that would certainly roll back the nuclear program and deliver a crippling blow to the regime's credibility and durability, and also send a powerful message to North Korea. Those are, I think, are options for rollback by the U.S. I think if some folks or the administration would see those as more assertive than they care to be, there's rollback by proxy, as you said. And I think most importantly, there's two elements, and I know we'll conclude here on this before taking questions, but is the, I think Israel here is, there, Israel effectively is the only country that is consistently trying to roll back Iran on the ground. They hit Iran repeatedly and their forces repeatedly in Syria. They try to deny weapons transfers to Hezbollah, or certain weapons transfers. They've hit targets in Iraq. They're the only country that is willingly and certainly fearlessly rolling back the Iranians, or seeking to. And by the way, they've suffered very little for it. Doesn't mean the Iranians haven't tried things, but they haven't succeeded in really any sort of retaliation with any meaning to the Israelis. So I think you have a country in Israel that is effectively doing our bidding, because our interests have completely converged, but they're willing to do this sort of thing. Well, we've been more hesitant. So I think that if we don't wish to pursue a more direct rollback policy, we should do whatever we can to augment Israel's capability to roll back the Iranians for Israel's sake, but also for America's sake. And I'll be very specific about that. I think, first of all, I'll just run this quickly, and this is some that Jinsa's put out in various papers over the last year. I think we could, we should conclude a narrow mutual defense pact with Israel. I think that would enhance Israeli deterrence and be a platform for greater cooperation between the two countries. I think we could try to accelerate delivery of weapons to Israel under the Obama MOU, the 10-year MOU of delivery of weapons, military assistance to Israel. I think we could do that, not by adding the dollar to U.S. taxpayer, but through various financing options that Israel bears responsibility for. And that would be like accelerated procurement of precision-guided missiles, F-35s, KC-46s, air refueling tanking, missile defenses, and so on. I think another thing that we could do is try to replenish and update the stockpile that the United States has in Israel, the weapons stockpile that could be for U.S. or Israeli use. And I think we could kind of elevate Israel's our relationship with Israel for boosting technology sharing, intelligence sharing, and so on. I think those, but I would say of all those, I think they're all important in augmenting Israel's military capability and deterrence. But I want to emphasize the weapons delivery. I think it's very important. Israel is using a lot of, and Jinsa's put out a paper about this in November as part of our U.S.-Israel security project under Admiral Jim Stavridis, a former NATO commander, and we've laid that out. I encourage everybody to go on our website or to reach out to Jonathan or me about getting the report. But I think that would really augment Israel's capabilities, the pre-positioning, but all of them. And I think by augmenting Israel's position and their capability to continue their campaign of rolling back the Iranians on the ground in the region, as well as preparing for what seems like right now almost an inevitable war between Israel and Iran and Hezbollah and other Iranian-backed forces, which would be extremely bloody and not really constructive for the region. But I think that's where we were probably heading, unless the regime collapses before then. I think we got to give Israel all the tools on the ground. It's like Winston Churchill said early in World War II, you know, give us the tools, we'll finish the job. I don't think the Israelis could finish the job, but I think we should give them more tools, because by rolling back the Iranians, they are not only advancing their own interests, but advancing ours. So I would really focus on this rollback by proxy as much as we can. There are other things we could do by proxy. I think supporting other forces to reimagining other forces in the region that are anti-Iran. The Kurds are certainly one of those forces. I think obviously they work with the Iranians, but I think by bolstering the Kurds, it also offers certain roadblocks for Iranian encroachment, and I think we should think about that with Syria, certainly with maybe some sort of loose confederation. But I think we could think kind of creatively about political solutions. It's not all about weapons, but political solutions that offer also roadblocks to Iranian expansion. But again, I think the Kurds is certainly one of those examples, whether it's in northern Iraq or in Syria. And I think, you know, some sort of a strong autonomous position by the Kurds in Syria would, I think, undermine Assad, you know, who's supported by the Iranians, but his reach in Syria. And I think we need to bolster our relationship with the Kurds as well. And I think that would be part of this rollback by proxy.
Well, that certainly underscored the element of this being a comprehensive pressure strategy. Thank you for that that detailed explanation. Harris, do you want to remind our listeners how they can get in queue for a call or for a question? And we'll start taking questions.
Absolutely. You can ask a question by dialing 5-star. And we do have some questions already in the queue. Matt from National Interest. Hello, Matt from National Interest.
Hello?
Yes, Matt?
Yes. Hi. Yeah, thank you for your talk. It was very interesting. I'm Matthew Petty, National Security Reporter at the National Interest. So you brought up the Soviet example and the 2003 Iraq example as kind of the two poles that the strategy or two opposing examples, but we also have some more recent examples of a hands-off regime collapse strategy, Libya, Syria, Venezuela, and arguably even what we did with Iraq with the no-fly zone and the embargo between 1991 and 2003. Do you think that the strategy was successful in these cases, and if not, what's different about Iran?
Good questions, and it's multifaceted, and I appreciate your publication and National Interest publishing my essay, so it's good to have you as a questioner. I'd say that it was a good question. There's no question I should have explained. I'm glad you brought this up, because I should have stated this up front. There's no question that a regime collapse policy has risks. The Libya example is a clear one of that. Gaddafi was a very bad man, but he wasn't really an enemy of the United States. And now we have a real problem with Libya, now with ISIS and with other, I got different countries involved, Turkey, Russia, and so on. So I think you're 100% right that Libya shows the threat, the risk of regime collapse. Now, just about that, I think the one clear difference between Libya and Iran is what I stated. Gaddafi was an awful person, but by the time he fell or he was toppled, he wasn't really an enemy of the United States. He had given up his nuclear program. I think that, as I said, the Iranians, they not only not giving up their nuclear program, but it's escalating. They're the leading sponsor of terror, one of the leading sponsors there in the world and certainly in the region. The regime is in its very DNA virulently anti-American, anti-Western, anti-Israel, of course, and anti our other friends in the region like the UAE and the Saudis, the Egyptians, and so on. So I think Iran today poses such a much greater threat to American interests than Libya did when Gaddafi was toppled. Therefore, I'm willing to take the risk of a regime collapse. I would rather work with the challenges that a regime collapse would pose than continuing with this awful regime.
Okay, we have another question. Steve Rademacher.
Hi, thanks, Harris, and thank you, Mike, for the presentation. When you talk about the Soviet model of regime collapse, one of the key contributors, I think, historically to that, in addition to what we had of a sanctions policy at that time, was Afghanistan and the U.S. support to the Mujahideen, which basically broke the back of the Red Army and handed them their first serious defeat, probably in the history of the Soviet Union. And if you look at Iran, there's some parallels. I mean, they're forward deployed in several countries in the region. Their forces are at risk in those countries. Have you considered whether there's some analog to basically the Reagan doctrine, the support to the Mujahideen that contributed so much to the collapse of the Soviet Union that could be applied in the case of Iran?
I think it's an excellent point, and for you to bring up Afghanistan. I see that as part of the Reagan doctrine, and I think that it's a very good point, and that's why I think the U.S. should be supporting. That's kind of more of my thought about supporting by proxy. But I think we need to raise the cost of Iranian involvement in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, and in Yemen. And I don't know which of those countries might be most analogous to Afghanistan. I would use that Afghan model exactly correctly. I would be arming those forces in these countries that are opposing the Iran-dominated capitals. The U.S. we have an advantage here. The Iranians are much more, I think, overextended and vulnerable than we make them out to be. They dominate capitals in Baghdad, in Damascus, in Yemen, and in Lebanon, that are capitals of countries that are not real countries, a bit like Afghanistan, actually. And these are not nation states as a Westerner would understand them. And therefore, you have peoples in these countries that don't really want to be dominated by these capitals that are supported by the Iranians. They might not necessarily be anti-Iran, but they're against domination by those capitals that are dominated by the Iranians, are controlled by the Iranians, are heavily influenced by the Iranians. So I think we should really raise the cost for them by supporting these forces. That's why I think the Kurds, for example, are a perfect case. I think that's the case if they could get their act together in Iraq. That's the case in Iraq. I think that's the case with the Kurds in Syria. I think we need to be supporting these forces so that the cost of Iran's involvement is going to be much greater. And it doesn't mean involving any boots on the ground. It just could be weapon supplies, maybe some protections, like the previous questioner from National Interest raised about, no-fly zones. But you could do things, I think, to help the people on the ground with weapons, no-fly zones, things like that, that I think could help these people in their opposition to these capitals that are dominated by Iran. So, yeah, I do see Afghanistan as a very good as a good analogy here.
Okay, we have a question from former chairman Michael Nachman. Michael Nachman.
Yes, hi. First of all, Mike and Jonathan, I really appreciate your presentation, and I think your whole concept here is very, very interesting and very supportable. One question, have you given any thought to what regime collapse would actually look like?
Okay, that's a good question, Michael, and thank you for your comments and all your leadership in the organization, including hiring me when you were chairman.
That was the best move I made.
We got that. We're taping this call, Mike. I would say that it's a very good question. There are different ways regimes can collapse. I'm not a political scientist. My academic background is in history, but you can look at different countries. Some countries or entities. The Soviet Union was like this multinational entity that was artificial to begin with. And I mean, you could argue Iran even is somewhat like that. There are a lot of ethnic groups, although some people would question that. But you've had easier transitions. You know, the questioner from the National Interest we talked about raised Libya. That is certainly not a great model. On the other hand, you have Yugoslavia, which broke up, and it was a little more, some elements were peaceful and some were bloody. The Soviet Union collapse, actually, since we keep talking about the Soviet Union, was by that point pretty bloodless. I mean, it actually was about as good as a collapse of an empire as you would want. It took a long time to get to that point. It took a lot of effort. A lot of people, unfortunately, had to die to get to that point. But the actual collapse, I think, was pretty good. Now, it had its problems, of course, and Russia still has many challenges, which is another conversation. We can engage Steve Rademacher for that. I think that the simple answer is, Michael, I don't know. What you would want to see, of course, what you would like to see, is you'd like to see a more liberal, preferably democratic society emerge, that the people come in the streets, that there are elections eventually, that the security, that the regime never enders or not really a threat to the new government. That's what you would want to see, but sometimes it works well and sometimes it doesn't, or it could be very bloody for a while. Again, I think the Soviet Union, the collapse actually went very well. I think with Yugoslavia, some elements actually went very well. With Libya, it hasn't gone so well. So you can kind of try to mark that out. I think the important thing here is it has to come from the Iranian people. We can't do, again, I would not advise doing what we did in 2003 with Iraq, coming in with our force to do it. It doesn't mean it doesn't work sometimes. It worked in Japan. It worked in Germany. The end of World War II, where you foreign, where that was regime changed by a foreign power. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't recommend that here with Iran. It really, the idea would be that the pressure is so great that the people really kind of come to the streets and the security forces recognize that they've lost and they're not going to kill people anymore. And at that point, then the people come to power. And if that comes to be, and I think there are a lot of liberal elements in Iran, and Iranian people are very impressive people, then I think the United States and other countries want to step in and do all we can to try to support the liberal forces at play. And I think that's the best we could hope for, but it has to come ultimately by the Iranian people. What we could do is pressure them, this regime, and ratchet the pressure. So these internal contradictions, these pressures that have already been building already for a long time now, but certainly in the last few years, that they really come to a boil and the people in Iran get rid of this regime, and then we help the forces that follow it. That's what you would want. But again, there's examples in history where things haven't worked out, but this is, I think, what we have to aim for. But thank you for asking that.
We have a question from General Frank Gortz, who was a 2019 Generals and Admirals program participant and a great friend of JINSA. General, the phone is yours. General? General Gorns?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Regime collapse, regime change, the subtleties of it all are interesting as a strategy, but I guess the question is oftentimes the follow-on is almost worse than the current. Is that the way? Obviously, you don't see it that way, but I don't know of anybody in waiting that has the ability to take over. And I'm just interested in your view on that because, you know, you mentioned Libya already. The color revolutions created some interesting dynamics. It was all an interesting exercise in freedom and power to the people. But, you know, in some cases, the remedy was worse than the disease. So I just want your thoughts on that.
No, General, thank you. And it's thank you very much for joining this call. We're honored honored for your involvement in JINSA. I would say, again, I do see an important distinction between regime change and regime collapse because regime change connotes U.S. forces or some foreign power actually doing the regime removal. And that's not what I'm advocating at all. I think we just have to ratchet up the pressure through different ways so the regime collapses, so we hasten the collapse of the regime. So I see it as an important distinction. But again, as you pointed out, I mean, I could add other examples, by the way, of regime change. We talk about North Korea, you talk about the color revolution. I could talk about Egypt, where the Morsi government, the Muslim Brotherhood, has taken over. The Arab Awakening, which I was, you know, not a big enthusiast of, just because I didn't, you know, the Islamists in a number of these countries have really gained, I mean, you know, a great deal. You know, one could argue, is Syria better off with 600,000 people dead and millions displaced and versus what they had? Although the Assad regime was and is awful, awful. So, Iraq has had a mixed history since 2003, to say the least. So you're 100% right. I think even recent history is littered with it's a very checkered recent history when it comes to regime collapse. I think the challenge with this, what you see with Iran is, I just see you have an unusual combination here of an extremely radical regime, the leading sponsor of terror, which is, I think, unrepentant. I mean, look what they're doing recently. They got a COVID-19 crisis pandemic, which they completely bundled. But what are they doing? They're still killing, they're still, they're foreign aggression, they're shooting in Americans in Iraq, they're creating a lot of mischief in Syria. They're not giving up their foreign adventurism. They're true believers over there, and they have nuclear weapons. So, I mean, if you had a Gaddafi with nuclear weapons and he was removed, I'd say, well, then we've advanced because you don't want a Gaddafi with nuclear weapons. But in Libya, in the case when with Gaddafi fall, he already given them up years before. So I think here, unless the Iranian regime gives up their nuclear program completely, agrees to eradicate it, which I don't see them doing, but if they do it, I just see this is a regime that it just got about as a negatively potent mixture as one could imagine. Terrorism, Islamic radicalism, completely anti-American, and developing nuclear weapons, and with threatening Israel and other of our allies in the region with elimination. So I got to think that a new regime, a new government in Iran, if it's, by the way, just, you know, the current supreme leader falls and the IRGC takes over, I don't consider that regime change. I mean a complete collapse of this regime. I would think that would be really beneficial, not only from a human rights standpoint and for the Iranian people, but for American interests. So I'm willing to, I think, roll the dice on this, just like I think for all those decades we faced the Soviet Union. And one could argue, well, what would replace that? You know, is there a Russian revanchism that would be worse than the Soviet Union? I think we're a lot better position right now, let's say, with Russia today, is, you know, with all the challenges we face today with Russia, than we were, let's say, in 1980 with them all over the world and, you know, with a very potent nuclear arsenal. So I think it's a very bad mixture in the regime, and I think it's worth, I'd like to play those odds for regime collapse with them, just like we did with the Soviet Union in the Cold War.
Okay, we have one last question. It's a follow-up by National Interest, Matt Petty. Matt?
Hi. Yeah, thank you for your answer earlier. I just also wanted to follow up because you brought up the coronavirus pandemic, which we know that the Iranian regime has bungled very, very badly, unfortunately. I'm wondering if the regime collapses, who you think would... I guess, what do you think the risk is of a regime collapse that's dragged out during a pandemic? I mean, is there anybody else waiting in the wings who would be able to stop Iran from becoming a permanent reservoir for the virus if the regime fell without a clear replacement?
It's a good question. I don't know. And it gets to the question the general asked, which I didn't fully answer about whether other elements that would take over. I'll just say this. You know, in my interaction with Iranian people, and my aunt married a Persian and Iranian, and I've gotten to know them over my whole lifetime. They're very impressive people. They're extremely capable people, the Persians, the Iranians. And I think that... I have faith, and maybe this is misplaced, but any regime, any government that takes over that is not the Islamic Republic of Iran, that takes over from this awful regime, will do a much better job. Look, as I said, they can't shoot straight except when they're pointing guns at demonstrators. Then they're very adept at shooting. They've done an awful job at the pandemic. They shot down that Ukrainian, you know, airliner, which a lot of their own people were on. This is an unbelievably incompetent regime and extremely corrupt. It's not that they don't have the money to deal with some of these problems either, by the way. They're just hoarding a lot of the money for themselves. I'm talking about the leadership. So I just have faith. I don't know. I'm not a political scientist, and even if I was, I wouldn't venture a guess about who would take over. There have been different leaders that have popped up that are more liberal over the years. Some of them have been on house arrest for like a decade. Maybe they would be the ones. There might be others. I would have faith that the Iranian people, who are very impressive, will be able to put together a government that's a lot better than this one, because I think the bar is just so low, and I think it would be very important for U.S. interests. So thank you very much for your follow-up question.
Okay.
Thank you. Dr. McCoskey, do you have any closing remarks?
No, I just want to say thank you very much. I appreciate all you joining today, and I appreciate the very good questions from people I know who ask very serious questions. I appreciate your engaging this. I would say that if you haven't had a chance, you might want to, you know, have a chance to read the essay. It's the only time I wrote such a long essay. It's like 5,000 words, but I recommend you looking it up on our website on the National Interest. Or it's linked to, I think, the invitation we sent out. And I want to thank Jonathan for doing a great job of moderating Harris. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Jonathan,
thank you,
do you have any closing remarks?
No, I just want to echo Mike in thanking everyone for your interest in this. And I recommend you go ahead to thenationalinterest.com to read the full essay. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. And we hope to see you in future calls. Have a great day and have a nice week. Bye-bye.